Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Toy department time, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you today, sir? What's going on in your world?
Oh, not much. You know, chugging along. Had my work day this morning, and I'll be headed to bed shortly after we're done.
Do you have that, like, I'm spent from talking sort of thing going on when you come in and do this, like, at the end of your day?
I don't get that too bad because I'm only on the air for an hour. You know, I'm a little spent just because my sleep schedule is always all out of whack. But otherwise, I'm okay.
All right. Glad to know you're 100%.
So, close enough.
Are you feeling any Oscar hangover at all? Because I definitely felt that the day after. Just like just a lingering bad vibes from the whole thing.
Really? So you thought it was bad?
No, it's not necessarily that I mean the show was meh, I would say.
Okay. Okay.
The show plus reaction to the show I found disheartening.
I feel like we might be on the same page about this. I assume you're kind of talking about the general reaction to Green Book.
Yeah, I would say the general reaction to the night in general, but definitely the reaction to and let me just say overreaction to Green Book, I think, is a big part of this. And
yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said that. I'm a white guy, right? And I'm Jewish, which I feel like makes me a little less obnoxious saying certain things than a non-Jew.
And some of your best friends are black.
Right, I'm not going there, right? Yeah. So, like, that's my whole thing, is, like, I don't want to say too much, but I do feel like, and, you know, I think we can readdress this when we get to Desus and Miro, but there's two guys who I think are actually, image aside, two particularly clever and thoughtful dudes about, you know, progressive ideology, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly were on the side of Green Book is white savior trash. But I kind of, and I might, look, again, I'm a white guy. And maybe I'm wrong. But I kind of feel like that ignores what actually happens in the film. Like, if anything, is it somewhat trite? Yes. If viewed as an allegory for racial issues in America, is it overly simplistic? Absolutely. But it's more of a black savior, right?
If you're going to go for the race movie trope, it's definitely more of the magical Negro movie than the white savior. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I keep hearing white savior and thinking, but why? And is Tony Lip a rather vast oversimplification of an Italian stereotype? Sure. But is it possible that's more or less who that guy was? I think definitely. Is the portrayal of Donald Shirley perhaps misleading in certain respects, based on what his family would say? I guess so. But at the same time, I didn't find anything about it to be unflattering.
Right.
Or...
And I would say, if we're talking about misleading, you know what I mean? Like, compare that to Bohemian Rhapsody. You know what I mean?
Right?
Any movie that's telling it, you know, is based on a true story is going to take some Hollywood liberties with said story. You know, I don't think anyone watched that movie, ignorant of the actual story, and then went, "This, I think this happened exactly as we it was presented." Right?
It's like, not a documentary.
Yeah.
And again, while it is, and I think we said this when we talked about it, and both really liked it, it is somewhat rote. It's not breaking new philosophical or artistic ground. It's not that movie. But it is a movie that we, at the time, said would be a really great Best Picture candidate because, for what it is, it's really well executed. I think it's as respectful as I felt was befitting its characters. And it's acted really well. And, like, I feel like, you know, mistakes, some bigger than others, by the people involved, have been cast in such a strangely aggressive oppositional light. And I understand that that's part of the time period that we're in, and it probably is a better world when neither white savior nor magical black guy movies are getting made. But as some version of that film goes, this is really good, and I did not find it nearly as problematic as it has now been positioned.
Yeah, and look, yes, the movie is trite, but I also think framing its victory as some sort of example of Whitelash, which I heard Brian Curtis, who I adore and respect, frame it on his podcast, like framing it as Whitelash is, I think, equally trite. You know,
I kind of agree, and I was shocked to see how many people, to your point, that I respect did that. Really shocked.
Just presumably. I also think we're getting to a place where, like, do we really have to be this precise with respectability politics all the time about everything? Particularly when we're telling a story, about a time that was a lot more ignorant. You know what I mean? Like, there's going to be some uncomfortable moments about telling a story about, people who survived the Green Book era, right?
Yeah, and here's the thing about that. I try to be really wary, and I think we're in a similar spot on this. I try to be really wary of becoming the old guy who just loses touch with how the world is these days, or what have you. But what I fall back on, especially as it regards our conversations here, is I feel like what I can say, if nothing else, because I can only have my own perspective, but what I can say, if nothing else, is that the two of us are so far to the left and to the, respectability politics hooray side of these discussions that when something seems a little much for us, even if in a perfect world, it's virtuous, it might not really be worth it.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think this entire Oscar season, from the length of the telecast to all this other stuff, was a case study in taking good intentions too far. Right? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, you know what's so funny?
Everything about it. To the hostless Oscars, all of it. It's all well-minded, decent reasoning taken to a place of absurdity.
Here's a really funny story that relates to that, and apologies to my wonderful family if they do hear this. A lot of that conversation, the length, what should stay, what should be cut. Were we on the podcast already when I said I watched the Oscars in a weird situation and had to go back and watch some of it online, or was that in our production meeting?
No, yeah, that was we did not discuss that on the pod.
So let me describe that situation to you because I think it reflects this issue. My parents were in town visiting. My aunt lives here. As does my grandfather, who is 92 years old and only so interested in doing anything other than hanging out at his place where he lives. And we decided it would be a good idea, which in retrospect, we should have known better, to gather at my aunt's home for the Oscars with me, my girlfriend, my parents, my aunt, and my grandfather. And my aunt DVR'd the Oscars, which was smart. And then, you know, dinner took a while to get ready, and then my dad had to make a run for wine, and then by the time he got back, and we had been watching the red carpet show in his absence, and we, by the time we finally started the Oscars, it was later than it should have been, probably after 6 our time, which is, you know, an hour in. And then literally every 30 seconds to 1 minute of the broadcast, somebody in the room said something like, "Who's that?" or "What movie are they talking about?" or just to the point where nobody had any idea what was going on, because the people who were confused were so talkative that the people who might otherwise not have been confused also became confused. And then because it was late and Grandpa was really in a hurry to get home, we started getting requests to fast forward through speeches by people who were considered uninteresting by the general group. And as a result, I missed some of the what, you know, afterwards, if you read the articles, would be considered the most interesting moments of the night in speeches that were declared uninteresting by people before they ever began. So, like I said, I had to go back and watch some of it, and it just, it didn't. And at a certain point, I said out loud in the room, you guys do realize this is essentially just a show full of speeches. And really, that more than anything is what this Oscars was, right? I mean, very few montages, pretty simple, straightforward performances, no significant host bits outside of the ordinary. You know, each presenter makes a crack or two. And I guess Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph did their thing for a little longer, and that was fun. So I thought the broadcast was actually uncharacteristically smooth and easy, but also, as evidenced by my family, perhaps less interesting to the average viewer.
Yeah, I've at this point, it's hard for me to even say what's interesting to the average viewer about the Oscars anymore. I don't know if it's just seeing celebrities in a room in dresses and tuxes that's interesting, or if people want the "You Really Like Me" big speech moment, or if people liked the musical performances. It seemed like the musical performances went down as much as anything on this podcast or on this broadcast. I don't know anymore. You know what I mean? And I don't think the show knows what people want from it anymore, as evidenced by the stumbling around and the adding and then retracting of awards and the removal of categories and then adding them back. The choices on those, like, do you think if they had just gotten rid of the short film categories, you know, animated short, live action short, documentary short, whatever, those, you know, three or four categories, that anybody would have complained?
Probably not.
Probably not, right? But they picked cinematography for some reason. It's like, it's like getting rid of the screenplay categories, you know what I mean?
Even makeup, well, I think it's worse, first of all. I think people, one of the things, if Oscars were to point, I think a good point would be to get people to recognize the importance and power of cinematography.
Right.
Rather than remove it from the broadcast. It's the exact opposite of what I think would make sense and be a noble
such
goal.
Such a weird choice.
It's ridiculous. But also, even the other ones were like hair and makeup, right? And costumes?
Yeah.
I mean, people see that.
I just think the
and it's popular movies in those categories also,
right,
is something that's probably worth mentioning.
I just feel like the kayfabe of the whole thing is now, it's been broken. You know what I mean? It's too far.
How do you mean?
Like, it's so obvious that there's so much politic involved in this body and their decisions. And I don't, you know, like we talk about Green Book being trite and problematic, but like, is it any more trite than, you know, kind of handing Spike Lee this sort of consolation Oscar, knowing that they weren't going to give him the director prize later on or really honor the movie? You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff goes on all the time. Or, I mean, the best director and best picture awards are so often tied together, and it's fairly obvious that Roma being a Netflix production is a part of why those things were separated. You know, and I'm not saying that, you know how we both feel about Roma. Neither of us thinks it deserves to win. But right. If you're going to, you know, award the director, clearly there are enough people in the Academy who thought it was great, that it, you know, it's a little curious that it doesn't win Best Picture. And we know that the Netflix thing is a factor in it. And we know that, you know, there are people who voted for Green Book for weird reasons. And we see these, you know, the traditional anonymous Oscar profile in which somebody says, you know, I think Bradley Cooper has enough going for him. Why do I need to give him an award? Like that, there's all of this stuff bouncing right. around, and front runners and precursor to award seasons, and this golden, you know, this movie is surging ahead, and we understand about all the campaigns now, right? Star Is Born suffered because they didn't really wage a big marketing campaign on it. You know what I mean? And obviously yeah. that stuff's been going on for years, but I think there's just a little bit more light on it. And I don't know that that's ultimately good for movies. And maybe it's idealistic to think that we could just have a show where people just voted on the stuff that they thought was best, you know?
Well, I mean, the fact is that may still be what we essentially have. And a lot of that stuff that you're talking about, that I am not disagreeing, I don't disagree. I think it does affect viewers. Like, I think we are less, you know, you're right that we're better off not knowing that stuff.
Yeah.
But I do wonder if ultimately that stuff is not explicit influence. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, these are a group of old white people but that have only recently...
They're less old and less white now. Like, there was a real effort to diversify the voting body over the last couple of years.
Yes, only recently and only by great effort, but still...
But the results are not necessarily getting better on that
front.
That's
not true.
You know what I mean?
That's not true. Do you think Moonlight would have won?
I mean, look at the, you know, almost complete shutout for Beale Street. You know what I mean?
The strangest thing about this Oscars is how little Beale Street got nominated. And I don't really know what to make of that. But at the same time, Black Panther got nominated.
Yeah, but wasn't taken seriously in any of the real awards.
I'm just saying.
You know.
I'm just saying.
I mean,
Black Panther... I'm not declaring victory. I'm not saying racism is over. What I'm saying is Black Panther did get nominated. Regina King did win. Mahershala Ali did win. Like... And when you hear some of the stats, Mahershala Ali becomes the second black male ever to win a second Oscar.
Yeah.
You know? Like... That's in the last 3 years. That reflects a changing academy, and that includes this year. Now, there's probably still a long way to go, given that Beale Street, I think, was that – did we agree that was the best movie of the year?
I don't know if it's the best movie of the year, but it certainly was in the top two or three.
And our other top – the other two in our top three, we had consensus on the top three, and neither of the other two were nominated for anything, right?
Right.
Eighth Grade and Sorry to Bother You.
And as Sorry to Bother You chalked it up to that we didn't do a campaign, right? You know what I mean? So
yeah, but it goes beyond that because it was also just a small movie, right?
But, you know, some small movies got nominated, I feel like, for things. I mean, The Wife is a small movie, you know?
Okay, but it was a small movie without a venerated multiple Oscar-nominated star that also was very off the wall and bizarre. So, again, the campaign does affect it. I'm just asking, does the campaign affect it more.
It did have Oscar-nominated Army Hammer, I might add.
What's that?
It did have Oscar-nominated Army Hammer in a main role there.
You're right.
You know, so but regardless, I don't know. I'm just annoyed. I'm annoyed at the if I could rant about one more thing, and I kind of talked about this on Twitter the other day a little bit. It's just the hindsight people, you know, who want to tell us how all this is going to age, you know. And oh, I'm on the right side of history, or you know, I saw somebody, I think it was for Vulture, write that Green Book is the worst Best Picture winner since Crash, and it's like, oh really? Like, but worse than The Artist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, what else is in that?
Like, well, there's a lot since then. I mean, I don't have the list in front of me.
See, Crash that's
was,
like
Crash was like 20
say,
years ago.
But isn't that like when people say Kobe Bryant's a top five basketball player of all time, but then you list seven guys better than him, and they're like, oh, yeah, I guess he's number nine? You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
To me, that's like you're saying that, but that's because you forgot some of the other – I'm just pulling up. This is me stalling for time while I pull up the actual winners of the last. So when was Crash? Like 2000?
I want to say it was late 90s. 2005.
Wow.
There we go.
Okay. So since 2005, The Departed was good, but I mean, certainly not Scorsese's best movie or anything. It was a Lifetime Achievement Oscar by many. No Country for Old Men was really great. Slumdog Millionaire, that wasn't great.
Riff.
That was a fine movie.
Again, the King's Speech?
Yeah, The Hurt Locker I liked a lot. The King's Speech wasn't good. The Artist wasn't good. Argo's fine, but nothing super exciting or special. 12 Years a Slave is good, but is it... I don't know.
I'm not sure The Shape of Water is demonstrably better than Green Book.
Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, I really liked. Spotlight was great. Moonlight was great. But yeah, Shape of Water I really liked, but I'm not sure I liked it more than Green Book. I would agree. And here's part of the problem is, and I think we probably both feel this way. I don't know if you agree about the specific films, but I would say for me, there are at least one, two, three, four to five films in the very category with Green Book that I thought were better films or at least as good as Green Book. But none of them are the ones that would have won if Green Book hadn't.
Yeah. And look,
so, like, I think we need to acknowledge, A, the Best Picture winner is not always a spectacular, mind-blowing film, and B, it's not always the best film of the year.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we look back on some of the, like, the great, you know, Oscar robberies of our time, if you will. You know, you think Forrest Gump over Pulp Fiction and Shawshank, or Dances with Wolves over Goodfellas, you know, or the Shakespeare in Love over Saving Private Ryan or whatever.
Oh, I have no problem with that.
Yeah. So
but I think The English Patient over Fargo offends me.
Yeah, fine.
Titanic over Good Will Hunting and L.A. Confidential offends
me. You could throw that in there, but it's like, you know, we look back on Forrest Gump and we go, okay, maybe it wasn't as good a movie as Pulp Fiction, but like, no one's like, Forrest Gump is terrible. You know what I mean? Like, no one is like Dances with Wolves. You know, maybe we think, maybe there was a better movie, but it's not like these things are like horrific tragedies of justice. You know,
also,
like,
by the
get
way,
over it.
By the way, Crash, which was murdered for, of course, and it's not like I'm defending Crash. It's not good. But the other movies that year, like, the really great one is probably Good Night and Good Luck, but that was never going to win.
Yeah, like how well Brokeback Mountain is the one that everyone thought was robbed, but like how well has that movie aged?
Exactly. Brokeback Mountain was the big robbery, but if Brokeback Mountain had won, first we'd look back and say, it was probably like the third best movie in the category. It just wasn't a great year.
Yeah.
So people, especially when you... When you declare that you know the future at this point in our history, when things move so quickly, and opinions change so fast, and history's view develops so rapidly. I don't see how you could say, oh man, we're gonna look back on this as a travesty of Oscar history.
Yeah.
Especially when, again, like, I'll be shocked if Roma ages well. Just shocked.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? Both of us kind of feel like we're going to be on the right side of history on that one.
Exactly. And same with Bohemian Rhapsody, which was the other probably main contender, right? Neither of us think those are likely to age well at all.
No.
And the movies that I think would have been, you know, equally or more deserving, Vice, A Star Is Born, The Favorite, Black Klansman, like, those were never going to win.
No. I think we're going to look back as A Star Is Born is going to be the one I feel like people feel like got ripped off 20 years ago.
And I kind of agree with that. And that's also the one that I think has led to so much conversation about Campaign.
Yeah.
Because that, much like Green Book, is trite and somewhat Hollywood formulaic, but really well executed, really well acted, you know, done at a high level for Hollywood, in some ways about Hollywood, you know, which the Oscars tends to like even more than movies about race that are simple. So, you know, I that's a little surprising, and that one does sort of reflect the importance of campaigning, I suppose. But in general, I think it's at least possible that this is a particular voting body voting its heart. And maybe the more diverse elements of that voting body that have been incorporated were split between movies like Black Panther and Black Klansman and some of the others on here.
Well, and I think just by having a more diverse body, you know, take it out of the Oscars, just full, you know, in general, you, probably is going to lead to some more, you know, kind of seemingly random results. In any situation, right?
So. Well, and especially the way this preferential ballot works, I think movies like Green Book that, like, probably most people felt pretty good about, even if there was some reaction in the voting. But I mean, in my view, most of this, you know, talking about how it represents white saviorism and a white lash and all that has been after most of the voting was done, when other award results indicated Green Book had a shot.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's been fairly prominent. I don't know about the timing of that. But I think we can just agree at the end of the day, at least Bohemian Rhapsody didn't win.
Right? Oh, thank goodness. Yeah. Well, and I think, like, more than anything, the real life, the people involved on the making the movie side of these two films both have some things that make them real world problematic, not just the content of their film.
Yep.
And the stuff on Bohemian Rhapsody is
much worse. Yeah.
Much worse. And I think in the end, I mean, look, where are we really going to be regretful? Is it going to be over the movie that maybe oversimplified race and could have been better, or giving an award to a monster?
Well, and you know what?
I'm like, glad.
This is a semi-hot take, but the further I get away from it, the less impressed I am by the Rami Malek performance in that movie, which is clearly the one thing that it has to kind of hang its hat on.
Yeah, I said, if you recall, I said that at the time, that, like, it's not that he's not good. He's very good, but I did think he really only did one version of Freddie Mercury throughout the entire life of Freddie Mercury.
And it was a really broad version of it, too.
Exactly.
I sort of wondered, like, watching when they played the little clip from during the Best Actor thing, and it was a scene where, you know, Freddie Mercury's at the piano, which is, I think it's funny, you're looking at this example of best acting and it's him lip-syncing.
Not lip-syncing, but sitting at a piano that he's not playing.
Yeah, like, what Bradley Cooper, who's like, you know, I fucking learned the guitar and how to sing for this damn movie and, like, changed the register of my voice. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not even a contender for this guy. I would be pissed if I were him.
Yeah.
I would be pissed.
I understand that. I do.
All right.
I think in the end, we'll look back at the Rami Malek performance as a really great impression.
Yeah.
But not necessarily an incredible acting.
Well, that's what people said about Jamie Foxx, too, when he won.
Well, I think that might be true, but it felt a little... I don't know. It felt less offensive in that movie for whatever reason. Yeah. I feel like that movie honored and told the life of Ray Charles a little more honestly than this did Freddie Mercury.
Certainly. All right, are you ready to get out of Oscar territory? Because we do have some other stuff to cover.
Stop it. Enough already.
I want to jump into. I want to start with documentary now. You know, we were texting last night, and I was like, you really should watch this.
Right.
I left out a piece of information that I had, having already seen it.
Which was that Fred Armisen wasn't in it.
Yeah. So I think this is an interesting control group, because we talked about when we assigned the show, the shadow that your Armisen hate casts over your feelings about this. So I'm very
distaste
curious
is
to
a
see.
Better word.
Distaste, yes. All right. That's fine. Distaste.
But I'll say this.
I'm curious to see if this. We have a control episode now. Yeah. How do you feel about an Armisen-less documentary now?
So a couple things, because I said last week, I was like, I do think he's a good writer. And I have to say, I felt after the first 22, you know, of this double episode, I felt curiously to have misspoken, if that makes sense. After the first 22 minutes, I was like, that was not very funny. And I don't understand, because I love Bill Hader. I think he's a phenomenal writer and like idea guy. And I think,
I will say that neither Hader nor Armisen wrote this episode. It's Seth Meyers wrote this one.
Okay.
Both halves.
Well, I will say the entire first episode, because what happens in the first episode is like a very broad and not that smart ripoff of Wild Wild Country. Like, taking some of the most base elements, exaggerating them without a lot of like consideration, it seemed, right?
Yeah.
And then immediately the second episode hits and you realize the sort of what the gimmick is, and from there it just escalated in hilarity, I thought.
Yeah. Look, there were some funny moments to me in the first one, like the obituary is funny, and there are a couple other things, you know. But
there were a couple of chuckles.
But a lot of it's just like they're getting the tone and the mood of the, you know, of the doc, right? It seemed like mostly what they were interested in the beginning. But
yes,
find out it's all set up. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Because some of the stuff that they did, right, seemed so stupid, you know, that I was like, now why would they, of all the things to parody, why would they parody that? And why would they do it in such a like over the top idiotic way? And then you realize, spoiler alert, if people want to watch it, which I would recommend it overall. I think it ended up being really worth it. But spoiler alert, you realize at the beginning of the second episode, the reason it's so goddamn stupid is that it's this stupid FBI sting, basically.
Right. But they mostly created as a joke to them, you know.
Right. And then that they totally lost control of,
right,
because this stupid idiot who got all hopped up on drugs, and this crazy lady started ordering him around. And that, I think, is a very funny sort of satire of what actually happens in Wild Wild Country, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Where, like, just doing a stupid version of it made no sense to me. Doing this is a FBI conspiracy version does make sense to me and is funny.
Right. And when the FBI agent is confessing, he's doing the helium confession.
Oh my god. The whole idea of helium confession.
Yeah, the helium confession
is so
great.
Funny.
It's really great.
And I thought, you know, Owen Wilson was exactly what I expected, which was good. He was definitely a funny shaman, but Michael Keaton is just so funny when he wants to be, man. Mm-hmm. And like, whether he's doing deadpan and playing sort of a straight man being funny or being wacky, so the way he delivers some of those lines that are so ridiculous, it's priceless. I thought he was spectacular in that.
Yeah. You know, shout out to Connie Chung Like, you know, dressing up in the 80s clothes again.
Yes.
And just straight manning those news reports. Like, thought it brought a lot of vibe.
Man, the phone calls between Michael Keaton and the agent who gets turned when he goes in.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, fuck you, man.
Those are great. All when they whenever they call Owen Wilson and he's like hopped up on coke and that, that
he's like, who?
Great.
What? What? The whole second episode really just because you as soon as it starts, you're like, oh, and then it just gets funnier and funnier. So it is definitely a recommend. It's still not my favorite construction to spend time every week, and I still feel like Fred Armisen's going to be in them more often than not, but I can't tell you I didn't enjoy this.
Yeah, well, and it's too the it's also can be troubling. These things can be troubling if you have not seen the Source documentary because they're such loving recreations, you know? So, And I have not seen any of the docs that any of the other episodes this season are based on. So, that could be interesting for me.
We got to throw some docs into homework. Jeez,
yeah, seriously.
I guess we're behind the times.
So who knows? Who knows with documentary now going forward? But there are some pretty great people involved, kind of all people in the sort of – I shouldn't say all people, but a lot of them in the kind of extended Saturday Night Live universe.
Yeah, and I didn't hate the last one we watched either, the David Byrne, the Talking Heads one.
Oh, good. All right. Well, there you go.
As I remember it. I don't know.
I do think, particularly if you don't have what was the word we used for your Armisen distaste? If you don't have an Armisen distaste, it can be a pretty enjoyable show.
I mean, it's a smart show by smart people, so, you know.
Yeah, a lot of good smart people involved. And they're clearly doing it, you know, on IFC as sort of this like labor of love.
So if we're going to talk about things with good actors that one of us doesn't like,
I think I know where we're segueing to.
I think my True Detective take is pretty middle of the road. In many ways, this was like a sort of not poor man's, but just like a different take on season one. And in the end, surprisingly, it kind of ended up being about human beings and relationships and that sort of thing, which is not really, I think, what season one was about. That being said, in retrospect, season one may have been more about that than we thought. And I liked it. I didn't think it was groundbreaking or earth shattering, but I liked it. So I don't know that I have much to add to the conversation, but I think you have a pretty non-mainstream take that is, I'm guessing, rather negative.
I mean, look, I'm not a True Detective hater. I will still ride for True Detective season two. You know what I mean? Which is not a thing many people will do. I feel like that puts me in the majority of true detective backers. You know what I mean? Like I'm probably to the left of a lot of people on that.
You probably have a spot on True Detective Island still.
Yeah, well, I'm giving it up. I have sold my timeshares. When we first started talking about this show, and I think really the only substantive discussion we had about it. I was into the beginning of the season. I was willing to see where it went. I liked the Mahershala Ali performance a lot. I found him captivating, and I don't think that dropped off. I think that he's a really good actor, and he was doing some really good work. And
Did you not think Stephen Dorff was excellent?
I was just about to say that I think Stephen Dorff turned in maybe some of the best work I'd ever seen him do. I would agree.
I thought, look, Mahershala Ali is hot, man. And this is like, I don't want to make this comparison because I've disrespected this, but it's like a James Harden scoring streak he's on right now. And I thought Stephen Dorff hung right there.
Yeah. Well, this I think if we're going to continue on that James Harden analogy, Nick Pizzoletto is for Atlanta Hawks, guarding him at the half court line with 4 seconds left to go when he has 28 points. the writing and the material of this season, I think, just really lets down the quality of the lead performances that we're getting here. This show is excruciatingly paced. It is so unnecessarily slow. The multiple timeline devices are tedious and ultimately worthless. And
worthless?
Yes, worthless. Like, what ultimately did it add other than to obscure things, ultimately?
Well, I mean, it's a mystery to some degree.
Yes, but you can tell this mystery in the way that it eluded them over a couple times without necessarily the bouncing back and forth and all the, you know, virtual star wipes from one timeline to the next.
So you would have just liked to see like 3 episodes each of
the
three timelines?
I mean, don't you think a lot of that was the excuse to put those two in wigs and makeup mostly?
I think it was a story told over time, and as a result, a story of relationships told
over
time.
But it's not an interesting story, so many of these characters are so poorly fleshed out, and in like all, you know, this is a thing that I think we can overlook in other seasons because there was more going on. But like the female characters are just ciphers, you know, like they just sort of exist as an extension of these brooding dudes in every season, and the principal relationship, like there's a scene and this was a real turning point moment for me where they're fighting in the bedroom, and it's like all we do is fight, we never fuck anymore, and all of a sudden she's taking off her clothes and they're banging, and it was like literally something that you see in like a bad porn movie. And I'm just like, how hacky are we getting in these portrayals and this marriage that I'm supposed to care about over the course of the 8 episodes? It just, none of it holds up. It's just not very interesting. The conclusion was not very interesting. Were you like, ultimately, like, do you think that the girl is alive or not? And do you even really care? I didn't.
I think she's alive.
Whether that existence is a fiction of his imagination, a figment of his imagination, or whether it's, you know, he really stumbled upon the truth. Ultimately, it's like, whatever. This show did well enough that there's going to be a season 4. I'm not watching it. I'm out.
All right. Well, I'll say this. It's hard for me to disagree with a lot of what you said. I think I just feel a lot of your criticisms, I feel them at a much lower intensity.
Yeah.
I don't think... Like, I thought... Well, okay. So this is telling. But I thought his wife, whose name I don't remember.
Me either.
Was the best female character we've seen. And that includes...
I'm going to give that to the Rachel McAdam character.
I was going to say that includes the Rachel McAdams character, which I did not think, for a main character, was really very well fleshed out at all.
No, that's what I mean.
I thought this was a real... This was Nick Pizzolatto trying, I thought. And... You're right, though, that certainly in general, and certainly with the other female characters, certainly the other wives or girlfriends on this show, they were accoutrement.
Okay, real talk. How many guesses would you have to get that her name was Amelia?
A lot.
I was like, I'm going to look it up, and I thought I would be like, oh, at the end of it. I wasn't. It's like, oh, Amelia. Her name's Amelia Reardon.
Well, yeah. To be honest, part of the issue was I don't think they said it that much. They didn't talk about her that much.
But I think that says a lot too. The one female name you know is Lucy Purcell, ultimately, right? Or no, not even Julie Purcell, rather.
Those two, yeah. I would have known those two.
Yeah,
and that's it. But listen, those are all valid criticisms. But I thought overall, I did think it was kind of an interesting mystery. I thought it was kind of a weird method of breaking the news, so to speak, at the end. Just having a guy sort of tell you the story of what happened outright. But I was interested in the mystery. I did want to know. I did think the acting overcame some of the... I don't want to say flaws, but like less interesting conversations. And I'd agree that it was on the slower side, but I wasn't so off-put.
I mean, this could have been 5 or 6 episodes, no?
Probably.
Yeah. And I mean, look, obviously, I think the point of difference for us is I just found the mystery thoroughly uninteresting.
Right.
Thoroughly. And that was probably from episode 3 or 4 on. To be honest. So, yeah, that's a bummer. I enjoyed some of the lead performances. I'll throw my boy Scoot in there too.
He's great.
You know, and although he's really chewing scenery, but I enjoyed it. I'll watch him chew scenery. It's fine.
Absolutely. And I thought little Meryl Streep was good too.
Yeah. She wasn't in it much, but when she went,
no,
she was
but
there.
Like people had their opportunities, and I thought everybody really kind of killed it. Which is why, although I understand your frustration with some of these things, and I don't disagree with some of the issues you've identified, I more or less enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did not. Did not enjoy that one. Yeah. All right. What should we do? We talk about fighting with our family, fighting with my family now?
Yes, I'm very interested to hear whether or not you enjoyed this.
I did. I really think that it was an interesting choice, by whoever, is in charge of WWE movie production, which is a thing, mm-hmm. by the way.
Yeah,
like WWE films is a thing, and there are quite a few of them. Most of them go straight to video, I think, but occasionally they pop up in a theater. But anyway, the choice to bring in Stephen Merchant to this, I think, really was an interesting and ultimately successful one. I wouldn't, it's interesting. I was watching, I think it was Broad City last night. I was watching something on Comedy Central, and they had a commercial for the movie, and it was clearly like a Comedy Central version of this, of the cut, because it was very like, come watch a great comedy. You know what I mean? And
right.
I don't think that it's like the movie has some laughs. I wouldn't call it hysterically funny.
I think it's pretty funny,
but it's funny at times, and it does have some real heart. You know what I mean?
Yes. I kind of loved it. And I feel like, unlike Green Book or Bohemian Rhapsody or whatever other problematic movie people liked, I feel like I'm in the clear with this. It's like sponsored by the people involved. You know what I mean? Like the people whose stories are being told are A-okay. It's got heart. It's funny. It's got good acting performances. And Vince Vaughn is great in this.
Watching Cersei Lannister just ham it up. It was a joy.
Lena Headey with a awesome. Nick Frost is fun, and I just love Florence Pugh. I'm buying all the Florence Pugh stock. I just hope I'm in early enough to get it at an affordable price.
I was a little like, she has a screen presence. I didn't love that performance a ton.
I don't know anything about Paige, but I know that Florence Pugh is just like a she's electric.
Can I bring up one thing?
Fine.
The ending doesn't make any sense to me. So, and I guess we should say spoiler alert.
I guess. I mean, there's not much of an ending, is that, which maybe is what you're saying.
Well, sort of, but also like the, you know, it's sort of, look, the fourth, well, the kayfabe is broken at various points in this movie, and they, you know, there's a whole scene where someone's like, oh, it's all fake, you know, and they kind of get offended. But in that scene, they point out, right, that yes, an outcome is predetermined, but the, you know, the bodies and the pain and involved in that are real.
I think that's the standard position.
Right, that is the standard position. So let's assume that that's true, right? Then how is it that they go into this climactic match in which the person making their debut in the WWE is somehow getting a title shot and then doesn't seem to be aware that she's going to win the match? Like, it's they sort of treat it like this thing that she did instead of a thing that was in fact predetermined. Also a thing that just wouldn't happen. Like, they don't take someone who no one's ever seen before and then immediately make them champion. Like, I'm pretty sure that's not how it really went down for Paige, who did eventually win the WWE title.
Oh, did you check that?
I did not. I did not check
WWE
it, but
film.
I don't believe that she did that in her very first match on Monday Night Raw. Although I guess it does say she...
in her debut match on the main roster, she won the Divas Championship, becoming the youngest champion at age 21.
All right, so I guess they just left out the fact that that was, like, predetermined, that she would have known that in the ring the whole time.
Well, I thought, much like the sport of wrestling, they didn't lie, they just didn't mention it.
I guess. I don't know.
They made it seem, and this may not be true, they made it seem like she didn't know she was wrestling till she got there. You know?
Yeah, which also seems a little weird.
Right. I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not. But that felt more Hollywood to me, whereas I had just assumed it was true that she had won the title in her first match, which it is. So I, like, yeah, it just kind of ends there, and like, oh, what a cool story. But I didn't need more than that. Did you need more than that? Did you feel unsatisfied by the storytelling? Because to me, I mean, it's like, I guess I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, that wasn't the point to me.
No, look, I'm not saying that was the point of the movie. Like, I mean, obviously, it's much more about the story and her family. I'm not saying it ruined the movie to me. It's just one of those things that, like, when I watched it, it didn't quite add up. The other thing I think that I would say is that, like, you know, look, this thing is a WWE promotional tool.
Of course.
And I thought it was interesting that there are allusions to the dark side of wrestling life, you know, but in a sort of like a Bohemian Rhapsody way, like it touches on these things, but it's not really interested in investigating them because we know these things get a lot darker than you would see in the movie, where people just go to NXT and they're living in Florida in a nice apartment and they work hard, but you know what I mean? But life is good and they're going to go to the main roster and be successful and that's the end, you know? Meanwhile, we know a lot of people in the main roster wind up killing themselves and whatever, and, you know, or they die of heart attacks at age 40 and, you know, people give their lives to these sports. It's not like I necessarily expected that in a WWE produced movie, you know what I mean?
Right. I mean, but, isn't that just sort of a, like, what it is.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a light fairy dusting. And like I said, I enjoyed it. But it's like, if you know a little bit about it, you know that there's definitely some things they left out, including Paige's sex tape, which
she has a sex tape,
which comes a little bit later after the the events of the film. Yes, she was eventually suspended from the WWE for a year. So.
Really?
Yeah.
They suspend you over a sex tape?
No, it was not necessarily about the sex tape. She violated the company wellness policy.
What does that mean?
Which,
is that drugs?
Which usually means steroids, but she claims it was not about steroids and then suspended again. Yeah, I don't know. Then the sex tape came out. Yeah, with the...
At like age 25?
Yeah, she retired from the ring, and now she's back, obviously, with the WWE, or they would not be making this movie. So,
right. I mean, obviously, she has some relationship, but...
Yeah, she had a neck injury, I think, which is why she's not wrestling anymore.
I see.
So, all right. Thank you, Wikipedia, for that full update on the life of Paige.
So we don't really know what she's up to, so to speak.
Indeed. Well, she's the current SmackDown general manager, so she has
she's on the shows.
Yeah, now. She's on the shows, but not wrestling. It's kind of her.
Got it.
So,
I mean, not so bad at 26 to be like in a comfortable working retirement.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that part's not bad, I guess. good for Paige. I'm sure her brother is thrilled.
Well, she seems like a nice lady based on the portrayal of her that I saw in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you some links.
That's okay.
Okay.
I know how the internet works if I feel compelled to seek that out.
All right. Should we get to Jesus and Mero?
Jesus Christ, I'll send you some links.
Should we get to Jesus and Mero?
That feels like a good lead into Jesus and Mero. Yeah.
You know, I saw a promo for the second episode of this show where Don Cheadle is the guest next week.
Excellent.
And they're like, it's Black Thursday. Join us as we talk to the other black guy on Showtime. Like, these guys are great.
Man, I hope they last.
I have a feeling they're gonna do well. I feel like the Showtime, moving from Vice to Showtime, is gonna give them a little more visibility and allow them to get some quality guests, and just them doing their thing is always a good time. It's always a good time.
Was there any concern for you that the appeal of this was as much or more the guests as the show itself? For this episode, I've watched it before, and this felt to me more or less like a normal Jesus and Mero episode, right? Like, yeah. It wasn't.
No, that's exactly what it felt like to me. So, that gives me very little concern that it won't be repeatable.
Right. No, I agree. But I do think the stars of this episode were the lady congresswomen.
Agreed.
And maybe that's a good thing for them, because their brand is strong, as they say. And I think, the coolest future for them, in my mind, looks a lot like this episode specifically, where they are talking to serious people about serious things, but bringing their own sort of real take to it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And look, a lot of times those serious things are things that don't necessarily get a real take. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And even though the women congressmen who to step out of the department briefly on the record as fans of, one of them is actually my congressman. Their version of real is a slightly performative real, but it's still super compelling television. And I think just by virtue of the fact that they're doing one weekly show now instead of the 4 or 5 a week on Viceland, I think you're going to kind of see that the extra time leads them to produce, I think, slightly more interesting versions of things. And you get, you know, you're going to be able to do more pre-tape segments and interesting stuff with that as well.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I also just think these are like, don't let them fool you. These are two really not just smart, but savvy individuals when it comes to, in particular, their brand and like image management, if you will.
Yep.
Like they know exactly what they're doing, and they're funny and they're smart and they have something to say. And they play to their strengths. Right. So like, I agree with you. We sort of said this when we assigned this for homework, and maybe we should check out Busy Phillips and some of the other ones, but like, this is the new late night. Like, Stephen Colbert might be great, and I'm sure still plenty of people are watching Jimmy Fallon, and I guess Jimmy Kimmel as well. But like, this might be the last generation of that.
Yeah. I'm almost surprised that this show didn't air on Netflix or Amazon or one of those. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that almost tells you even more so, like, listen, Showtime's looking for big hitters, right? So like, they really believe this is a thing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. They're to me one of the best bets for being a thing. You know what I mean?
And Showtime doesn't pick this up if they don't think it specifically gets them subscriptions. That's why Showtime picks up existing property.
Right. And look, and all of us know, the two of us know, I should say, from having some familiarity with sports television, that just getting in business with Eric Rideholm is a good idea usually.
So, he's had a lot of success.
That guy knows how to produce television shows and really has developed some pretty random people from other walks of life into pretty big television stars. So,
yeah, that's true.
All right, should we jump into homework? Because I got to get running here.
Yeah, I guess we should.
I'm 100% willing to take the blame. I assigned us OG for homework, and then I forgot to watch it. Just straight up forgot.
You blew it. Yeah. And, quick preview, I think you at the very least missed a really compelling acting performance.
I did. That's exactly what I was expecting. So we'll find out. So we'll talk about that next week. That's one less thing that you got to watch, I suppose, because you've already done it. And then Better Things is premiering on Thursday.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, because I anticipating that, my girlfriend had never seen it, and I was like, hey, we should start this from the beginning. You should check out this show, Better Things. You're going to really like it. And, of course, you know, it starts up, and she's like, man, Louis C.K. is really involved in this, because he's like producer, executive producer, director, maybe even co-writer.
He's a co-writer, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
And so even with that trepidation, 10 minutes in, you know, we're both laughing, and it's just like, it's just such an incredible, for people who haven't watched it and need to be convinced, it's just such an incredible real portrait of just a whole gaggle of just well-drawn women characters. And even if Louis C.K. engaged in some of the drawing, it's really excellent.
Yeah. He's involved in all but one of the episode of the first two seasons, and more than a few, he's the sole writer on.
So obviously that has changed.
Yeah, and then season three, no involvement at all. So
we'll see what that means for Better Things. But I have a lot of belief in Pamela Adlon.
Yeah, the ratings for season three, or the reviews rather, for season three have been very high, good so far. So. I haven't read them, but I've read the headlines.
right.
So and you know, I just have a lot of love for the show, and so I'm pretty excited about that one.
I totally agree. This is my big excitement until we get to April when I think the two biggest shows of the year are coming back.
That I'm also excited about the television version of What We Do in the Shadows, which will be out late March.
That'll be fun.
That'll be between now and then. Are you excited about Paddleton?
You know, I love a Duplass. And
I also
did you happen to watch Ray Romano's stand-up?
I have not seen the stand-up special. We have talked about Ray Romano's work lately in a number of things, you know, drama shows and stuff, and I think we've all been pleasantly surprised at how good an actor he's become. So I'm interested to see what these two guys do together. I like this combo. So
me too, and I like the look of it as like a dour sort of dramedy. It appears to be. And I feel like that suits the performers, and I'm excited to see what it's about.
Yeah, we'll see what else we come up with between now and then. Do you have any interest in checking back in on You're the Worst, or do you want to wait till season's end with that?
No, I don't know offhand how far away season's end is, but I could be done with that.
I think there are two more episodes left.
All right, maybe we just wait then, but let's see what else we come up with.
All righty. I think that call is probably my cue to.
Well, you better go answer the phone then. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.